Now, have you been giving to the famine appeal for Somalia? If so, you may be interested in this next debate, which centres on the way we use humanitarian aid. Are there too many agencies? Are they competing against each other for business? Are they paying off militias? Couldn't the money be put to better use if we planned properly? Well, Samir El-Awari is with the Overseas Development Institute. First, Linda Polman in Amsterdam wrote a book on the subject and is a critic.
Last time there was an attempt in counting how many international aid organisations there were, and people stopped counting at 37,000.
Is that a bad thing?
It would be nice if they would combine all their forces and they would combine their budgets to work towards communal goals for the good of mankind, but they don't. They are in fact competing with each other for shares of the aid budgets, of the donor budgets.
So there's an element of self-perpetuation there, that you want to keep your own charity in business.
Well, I mean, you have to be in the picture of the people that actually give you money, which could be our governments, and you have to be in the picture of people like you and me who give £10 out of our pockets.
But that doesn't mean that the aid is going to the wrong place or that the aid isn't working, does it?
Not necessarily, but in many places it does, because this self-interest means that aid organisation, if necessary, they will put their own self-interest before the interest of the victims. You can see this happen in an interesting way in Somalia at the moment, where you have the WFP, the World Food Programme, trying to get funding for feeding people, but they are not getting access into the area where the hungry people are.
Okay.
And at the same time, there's the International Red Cross, who does get the access, and they have to compete with the WFP for those funds.
Okay, Samir, what's your response to that idea? Is that broadly correct?
I mean, I think that it definitely has developed into an industry. There are many different organisations, although you will find that there's a small number in terms of about 6 NGOs that dominate the industry with about 40% of operational expenditure. So, yes, there is competition between agencies, there are self-interests, but I don't think we have to take a cynical approach either to say that all humanitarian organisations are just in it in order to kind of become bigger, to promote their brand, and for the individuals working in those organisations to get good jobs and salaries. I think ultimately they are there to try to respond to humanitarian needs, and there are extreme difficulties in actually doing that. So in Somalia, working where some of the core areas of humanitarian need, where there's declared famine, is controlled by Al-Shabaab, a militant group, which is not allowing access to humanitarian agencies or allowing very limited humanitarian access. And it's true that organisations are trying to fundraise in order to respond to those crises, and some are getting in, such as the Red Crescent Society, such as other organisations such as Islamic Relief, and others are finding it more difficult, such as the World Food Programme.
Yeah, and then it would be nice if the organisations that are getting access to where the aid is needed, it would be so nice if they would be supported by other organisations who are not getting the access. But what you're actually seeing is that those organisations start competing with each other. It's not like the WFP is donating its budget to an organisation that is getting access. Why doesn't the World Food Programme, who was not allowed into Al-Shabaab area, donating its budget to the ICRC, for example, that is getting access? That would be the cooperation that would be in the interest of the victims, of the people who are hungry now.
Samir, I'm also interested in this idea, when there is a problem in one part of the world, like Somalia, for example, that we end up with these massive camps. You know, people, I don't know whether they're told to do that or they just make their way there. But does that in a way suit the aid people, because they're all in one place? And is that actually sensible? Because surely you get trouble there and you get disease.
To a certain extent, that is true. And I think camps have been developed because it is much easier for aid agencies to deliver assistance to people in need that arrive to those camps. But I think there's also pressures from them to form camps. So the Kenyan government is quite clear that they are only willing to accept refugees on a certain limited area of land. And therefore, aid organizations need to set up camps in those areas. If there was a more open asylum policy in Kenya, then you might find some of the refugees being able to kind of settle in Nairobi, to settle into other places where they might have other opportunities to support their own livelihood. So I think that it's a combination of, yes, it is easier to support camps, and in a sense it's slightly self-interested that we can direct aid there. But I think there's also pressures that they can't just choose how they respond. There's mm-hmm. also other governments that are putting pressure on them to respond in that way.
And this is why it would be good if those refugee camps, those huge camps, start to come into existence in war zones, for example, where it is known that warring factions are in fact directing the aid and telling who can eat and when. It would be so good if those camps would be better policed policed by the international community, don't just stop the job at bringing those people food, but actually try to keep order and justice inside those camps. I think the aid should be accompanied sometimes by force if necessary.
Samir, one of the things that will be striking to people who do donate is just how frequently this recurs. It keeps coming around, and often actually in the same parts of the world. Not always, but you know, this particular current crisis is recurring. And if you put all the money that's been put in aid over the years, if it had been invested properly, it might have avoided these difficulties of drought and starvation in the first place.
I think absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, some of the warnings about the famine at the moment came last August. And, you know, those clear early warnings, the early warnings worked, but unfortunately, early action didn't follow the early warnings. And I think that there's a tendency often to focus on this kind of short-termism, to provide food aid once an emergency has started, as opposed to trying to support people's livelihoods before the emergency occurs and trying to support their resilience and coping mechanisms, which in this case would have involved trying to support pastoralist livelihoods, you know, in these drylands. Often pastoralism is often one of the main mechanisms of people's livelihoods, and unfortunately there was not enough effort put into supporting those livelihoods.
I agree with Mr. El-Hawari completely. The truly sad thing about this is that nobody can be held accountable for this. We have all these very, very expensive early warning systems, and the early warning systems are functioning. We can predict when and where famines will occur, and nobody is acting upon it because nobody is being forced to act upon it. We are all free to answer to these warnings or not. So it would be so nice if we would investigate why the early warning systems were again ignored by the international community and who can be held responsible for this.
You see, you do wonder when we look at how man is able to go to the ends of the earth, and currently in the Arctic, for goodness sake, to extract from the earth, to take minerals and to take wealth from it, and yet on something as basic as providing irrigation and food and keeping people alive, we fail.
It is very, very sad, yes. We pour billions into humanitarian aid in feeding people emergency rations. If we would have spent the billions in a more sensible and a more humane way, considering the future of these people, they have to live beyond this famine, we could have prevented a lot of what's happening now.
Samir, should people think about not giving?
No, I don't think that's the case, because I don't think that a lot of these problems can be all finger pointed to the aid industry. Now, the aid industry obviously has its shortcomings. They didn't respond to the warnings and are now providing emergency assistance when maybe 6 months ago, 8 months ago, they could have been supporting people's livelihoods to cope with the drought. But at the same time, you know, there is a conflict in Somalia. There's a very weak government in Somalia. There's a lot of international interest in Somalia. I think we need to be careful where we point the blame. I mean, there are no humanitarian solutions to humanitarian problems. And ultimately, we need to be looking at governments, we need to be looking at the UN, we need to be looking at the African Union to support these longer-term stability in the region that will eventually lead to, hopefully, development outcomes and some sort of social protection for the people living in those contexts.
We are pouring billions and billions and billions into the Horn of Africa. So it's not like, should we give? We are giving, but the question is, what are we giving for? What is the goal with the money? Do we have this long-term strategy? Is our real goal to stop the suffering of these people for forever? And again, if we would spend the money in a more sensible way, lots of this could have been prevented.
But I do think that we do need to make a distinction between humanitarian funds. Now, humanitarian funds are there to save lives and to alleviate suffering in times of acute crisis. They're not there to solve the causes of the crisis. Therefore, if we want to solve the causes of the crisis, we need to be looking at development funding, we need to look at security funding, political funding.
Yes.
So it's not so much trying to say we shouldn't be giving so much money to humanitarian action, but we should be saying, how is funds for other types of activities being used, and are they producing the outcomes they claim to be producing?
Yes, and then we come back to the beginning of the conversations. Aid organizations, the aid industry, should be working together to this international goal with a vision for the future of that part of the world. Budgets should be combined. Strategies should be combined to put a stop to the terrible disaster that is repeating itself every couple of years there.
Linda Pullman and Samir El-Hawari.